like to call to order the State Government Finance Committee meeting for April 5th. Representative Harder, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, I have, and I'll move the minutes. Thank you.
Representative Harder moves to the minutes of, look at the date on, I'm sorry. April 4th. And
2024.
Thank you, Representative Nash. 2024. Are there any objections or any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are approved for April 4th. Representative Cleburne, to continue your bill, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to start to just say Representative Nash and I had a conversation yesterday, and we continued that conversation this morning. And we just kind of want to restart fresh this morning. And I'm going to ask Mr. Huffman, who is with me this morning, to just give a very high overview of what is contained in the bill, so that the members of his team have an idea of what this redistricting bill looks like in a very high level. So if you would please recognize Mr. Huffman.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Hoffman, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, I'm Paul Huffman. I'm the election and redistricting policy coordinator for League of Women Voters Minnesota. This bill, HF 4593, has three main components. Article 1 is the proposed constitutional amendment that would establish an independent redistricting commission composed of 15 citizen members, five affiliating with one major party in the legislature, five affiliating with the second party in the legislature, and five affiliating with neither of those parties. That constitutional amendment includes requirements at a very high level for selection, for the eligibility to be on the commission, and methods for removal, and some requirements for hearings and quorum for the commission. And the exclusions we talked about somewhat yesterday. Article 2 of the bill is the implementing legislation. That implementing legislation provides much more detail in a granular level about how those specific activities with submission applications, screening applications, screening of potential commissioners, the selection process, and then the conduct of activities for the commission, you know, such as establishment of a selection panel composed of members of legislative members of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, how that would be administered and supported from a resource standpoint, primarily through the Legislative Coordinating Commission, but expectation is that that would be primarily through contracted resources, very similar to what either Supreme Court does or other governmental bodies do when they do redistricting, employing legal and technical expertise. Includes in that some provisions for the specific numbers, conduct, method of conducting public meetings and hearings. A key feature of that is creation of what we refer to as a redistricting advisory group. What we recognize, and through outreach and involvement with impacted communities, minority communities in Minnesota, is that is the most significant growing part of our population in the state. It is also a group that frequently is not as well connected and has a sufficient history with governmental bodies. So in order to ensure that there is that connection and reflection of those communities and those members of our state, that advisory group composed of, for example, members of the ethnic councils established by the state to advise that selection process and advise the commission on how and where and in what manner to best engage people in Minnesota to get that public input and participation in the process. You know, so that's Article 2 of this bill, and establishing a detailed timeline to ensure that the maps are done with a target date of September 15th of the year ending in one. That is consistent with other states to provide sufficient time for legal challenges and resolution in a timely manner should there be any challenge to that before the statutory deadline in the year ending in two. In this is also provisions that we've got from best practices from groups such as Brennan Center, who you've heard from, Campaign Legal Center, and reviewing those independent redistricting commissions in states that have been established, what their lessons learned are, as well as lessons learned from states that have had failed commissions, such as Virginia, New York, and others. So those are weaved in there. It includes provisions if there's a deadlock commission, which has been a problem in other states. I'll just add that. Article 3 is provision for an advisory commission. And this would provide a mimics in a lot of the mechanics what is in the Article 1 and Article 2 for independent commission. The reason that we include the advisory commission is that, especially as we talk to impacted minority communities, a lot of this about representation is how to ensure that their input is taken and reflected in the maps that result for redistricting. As some of you are aware, Minnesota had a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 1980 for redistricting. That item got 58% approval, however, failed to pass because it didn't get 50% of the votes cast. So there's a real concern that people are not going to turn their ballot over. Something that may be overwhelmingly popular may not meet that threshold. And so for those minority communities, they want that safeguard that something will come out of this if there's not sufficient notice and interest to get the ballot turned over. So that's the purpose of the advisory commission. We still feel that is a democratic process. It reflects a lot of the same best practices, but still provides a means to gain in a structured manner, in a transparent manner, public input. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. And Madam Chair, would you like to open it for more public testimony, or do you want to go right to member questions?
I would like to recognize Anastasia Belladonna of Common Cause. She does have a letter that has to do with the voices of the community that she would like to read on the record. So if you would please acknowledge Ms. Belladonna.
Ms. Amadonna Carrera?
Belladonna Carrera.
Belladonna Carrera.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning, members. Mr. Chair, this is Anastasia Belladonna Carrera, the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. First, I'd like to apologize for not being there in person. Unfortunately, I recently came back and tested positive for COVID, so I'm under self-isolation. But I'm actually here to support the collective work of With Us For Us redistricting amendment reflected in House File 4593. This historic legislation centers on the needs of Minnesotans and not outside interests or politicians. And again, we want to thank Representative Cleveland for moving this bill. House File 4593 was co-created with input from about a dozen community organizations from impacted communities and a broad base of stakeholders, partners, members, and allies. To date, as I mentioned yesterday before my unfortunate signal issues, almost 2,500 Minnesotans have already submitted written statements in support of House File 4593, and we are still counting. And we ask members of the committee to boldly stand with communities and that have worked on this for 5+ years in co-creating a clean and transparent independent redistricting commission reform bill. Again, building a multiracial democracy must be driven by different communities across the state and co-creating a shared vision for an inclusive democracy. House File 4593 has been in the making since actually a little before 2018. Our first efforts at reform, some of you might remember this, was House File 1605, and it began with countless of even ongoing statewide conversations in backyards, farmers markets, art fests, churches, community rooms, county fairs, rotary. I'm literally reading down the list of the areas and spaces we've been in throughout the years. Rotary club meetings, town halls, door knocking, connecting with diverse groups. And I have to say that not all of these conversations were easy. There was a lot of listening. We also engaged legislators in both chambers and parties. We wanted to make sure that the ideas were inclusive. Some members here today both challenged us to do better and provided direct ideas that were in fact captured in 1605 and are now also in House File 4593. We engaged our national partners. Paul mentioned a couple. We also engaged folks from Tufts University and from Harvard that also worked on the metrics of measuring partisan bias, et cetera, making sure that we were centering best practices. We leveraged that and the lessons learned. We finally spoke to commission members from state and local commissions across the country that have already implemented these reforms. We wanted to know about what worked, what didn't. What would they do differently and why? During the 2021 redistricting cycle, we came together and proved that community can lead the work of drawing its maps. We negotiate what those maps ultimately represented and informed the maps that we actually litigated. And together, we moved the needle for many impacted Minnesotans across the state, particularly the largest of the four nations. I want to spotlight that of all of the maps submitted before the court, it was our maps that maximized opportunity districts, split the least cities in doing the work, and both were constitutionally sound and followed what the court instructed for us to do. We were incredibly proud of the victories our organizing collective grassroots achieved. The unity maps, which I just referenced, were submitted and impacted communities were able to show that we achieved those things I mentioned. And more importantly, I know that I heard yesterday someone say, what's wrong with the current process? Why not continue letting the courts do this? I wanted to share that the final maps that the judicial panel actually approved fell short in some respects. And the panel actually explicitly in the opinion accompanying the maps that it rolled said that it believed it was not empowered to make wholesale changes to existing boundaries. And as Paul also mentioned, in a state where growing communities of color and Native nations continue to grow and contribute mightily to the state's population growth, economic activity, and cultural vitality, institutional inertia and status quo is not going to do. It's just simply not meeting the needs of all Minnesotans. So in our opinion, House File 4593 is the best option because of the reasons that I just mentioned. It also maximizes opportunity for transparency, accountability, and public participation in the ways that is community-facing while leveraging all of the awesome things and contributions and lessons learned from others. I want to thank again Representative Cleburne for your partnership in co-creating a vision for an inclusive democracy that stems from Minnesotans coming together, and I think that's really important. We're grateful to our allies for the years of working to analyze what will make redistricting work in Minnesotans, including all of our legislative allies. And we're very proud to support 4593 charting a new path forward to fair representation and greater parity among Minnesotans. Again, I respectfully ask that you please, on behalf of all of the various folks and stakeholders we've been working with for the past several years, boldly stand in support of this collective work. It truly reflects the diversity that we are as Minnesotans in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Belladonna Carrera, and your hard work that you put into this. Madam Chair.
If we could please move on to questions from the members.
We'll move on to members to the questions, just so the members all know that this bill is being moved to the Rules Committee. Members. Representative Harder. She raised her hand. Oh, I have to go to Representative Newdahl.
No.
Oh, I'm new at this.
Thank you. Representative Harder, you're up.
Thank you, Chair Hewitt and Representative Cleburne. Okay, I have two questions, okay? The first one is I need some clarification and a better understanding because this bill is new to me. And yesterday we heard a bill that also addressed redistricting, if I understand. What is the difference between your bill and that bill? Is that I need some clarification, please.
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you, Chair Hewitt and Representative Harder for the question. At the very high level, this bill is singularly focused on an independent redistricting commission. There are no other pieces of the Constitution which are addressed in this particular bill. Do you have a specific question that you would like to know about, whether it's the composition of the commission or the way it's enacted?
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Hewitt. I was just wanting to gather a better understanding what what was the difference, because we talked about it yesterday, and then there's this bill, and I just wanted more just clarification on that, which I think you addressed, because this is a single issue versus the other one that had several issues within that bill.
I can ask Mr. Hoffman to address the question more fully.
Mr. Hoffman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Harder. Several things. One is that, there's woven throughout this bill is measures through the number of hearings, the manner of hearings, the presence of what we refer to as a redistricting advisory group to ensure the engagement, participation, minority, and impacted communities in Minnesota. So that's something that is unique to this bill. It's not something that is in one article or another, so you can't cherry pick it out, but it's woven throughout. The second aspect is, I would say that there is in some of the provisions for how maps are drawn, some specific items that would ensure the ability of the commission to draw maps that fully reflect the interests of the people of Minnesota. It's on occasion that things can be specified so tightly to ensure mimicking the partisan balance of elections that doesn't give the opportunity for ensuring that communities are effectively represented. So we feel because it starts with that community input that it addresses that. So those are two of the things, I think, in particular, that community input and how the hearings are done and the level of detail and how that's done, so it's not left for as much determination of the commission or legislators in future, provides that greater confidence of the greater visibility and transparency.
Representative Harder, is there a follow-up?
I just have a comment and one more question. Okay, personally, I like citizen boards because they do bring a value and a wealth of knowledge and backgrounds, and I consider that to be important. However, it just seems on some cases that over time, some of these citizens end up bringing their own agendas, and then sometimes it appears that they appear to be activists, which may not necessarily bode well for the entire state. So I'm just wondering, how can we avoid members of this commission that might have personal agendas? I mean, is there some sort of plan with that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hewitt. I will say that the entire bill is set up to best align the selection process to be transparent and to protect against those partisan interests that you're talking about. And I would just like to say that there are members of your side of the table when this bill was initially constructed in 1605, House File 1605 in 2019, which pushed back to make sure that we had protections in the bill that would ensure. And some of those members are sitting here today. So I'll just say that at a high level, and then I'll ask Mr. Hoffman to address it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Harder. What I'd say is in the application process and the selection process, there's specific requirements to identify civic organization involvement and civic engagement and what you're involved in. So you have to identify that for the previous 5 years. There also is an interview process that involves members of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, which are legislators, party balanced. That is an opportunity for legislators to interview the potential commissioners surface based on the application information. The screening has been done if there are those kinds of agendas present. And then those are identified, documented, those candidates ranked. And then based on those ranking, there is a selection process. So that provides both the disclosure that's required to be signed under affidavit, the screening, review, and then interview of those candidates to sort out if there are people who are coming in with some specific agenda.
Thank you.
Oh. Mr. Chair, I just would like to add the other piece of this, which we touched on briefly yesterday, but members can be removed for voting or behaving in a way that is contrary to what they stated in the affiliation process. And if they try to disrupt the work of the commission or if they damage the integrity of the work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Claiborne, for bringing this bill. There's a lot in here. And I'm sure it's in here, and I just didn't see it. Who is the primary overseer of the committee? Does it end up creating like a committee administrator? Is there one person or one? I know the Secretary of State's in here, the LCC commissioner's in here for different levels. The details are significant, and I'm going to get into a couple of them. But is there one person that kind of organizes this effort?
Madam Chair? Mr. Watson, I guess she's pointing to you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nadeau. Every state has to find an administrative agency to house this. The Independent Commission is independent of itself. The only body that can, the only court of reference for actions of the commission is the state Supreme Court. For purposes of administration, the Legislative Coordinating Commission provides the administrative support and resources. What we determined was having the commission itself responsible for hiring, maintaining, staffing, administration, given that it's a citizen body, not necessarily familiar with governmental practice, contracting, all of that, finding an agency was appropriate. Where we landed us on the Legislative Coordinating Commission. They already have a branch in their GIS office that supports redistricting and mapping, that has a source of technical capability. They understand contracting. We've met with the executive director of the LCC on how that might work. So from that standpoint, they provide administrative support, but they don't provide oversight. And I think that's an important distinction. The oversight for the commission is effectively the state Supreme Court. They are a body impaneled by and empowered by the state constitution, and therefore they are independent of the legislature and of those legislative and those administrative bodies. They have to adhere to state law, and which again goes to Representative Cleburne said, the removal process if somebody doesn't adhere to the law about the conduct of the commission, and ultimately accountable to the state Supreme Court if their maps don't comport to the constitutional or legal requirements.
Representative Noah, do you know a follow-up?
Yeah, I've got a couple. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, but the Supreme Court is not going to be engaged in the process. They will have oversight, correct? LCC is going to do all the administrative work in getting the taking applications for commission members, for advisory members. That's all happening through the LCC.
Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nadeau. That the application process for getting the applications out, receiving them, just making sure they're complete, that is intended to go through the Secretary of State's office. It's an administrative function. They already do some of that function. Once that initial set of applications are received, they would go to the LCC, which would then do the sorting and the internal processing. The intent and in the bill, in the implementing language, is language saying that it's expected that while a lot of these responsibilities are assigned to the LCC executive director, it's expected they would contract resources to do these things. For example, in the interviewing and ranking process, those of you who are in business, there's a very consistent methodology for doing that. HR professionals understand. So you would probably engage an HR professional to do that. They would engage experts in GIS to do certain things. So that selection process would be administered by the LCC. But for example, the selection panel would be members, legislative members.
Representative Joel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there is you can just nod. There's no fiscal note on this. There is. Mm-hmm. I got different answers.
The chair indicated that there is a fiscal note on this.
Sorry.
Okay. I'll look at that in a second. So, Representative Cleburne, and thank you. There was a couple of things I've noticed in here. I just want you to provide, and I'll just list them out, and then you can address them. Will the commission and or the advisory body need to be compliant with open meeting law? The second one is, do you see that there might be some problem with, in order to move anything forward, there being two-thirds vote required of the commission? Can you talk a little bit about that? And then the final one I want you to talk about is the ineligibility to run for office for 5 years once one gets appointed to this commission, and how that might be enforceable.
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you very much. There is a provision for open meeting. Yes, it's very transparent. It actually states in the legislation that things cannot be done in secret. So the transparency is definitely there. You ask about the problem with two-thirds vote. No, there is a fail-safe system also in the bill that outlines the process if that happens with a deadlock, as we discussed earlier. And ineligibility for 5 years, no, I don't see a problem with that because this is a self-selection, self-applied criterion. You know that when you apply to be on the commission.
And just one final.
I'm sorry, Representative Nadeau, is this the last one?
I promise.
Thank you.
I had two, but I'm only going to ask one. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. Are there other states? This is a robust redistricting plan.
I call it awesome.
I hope it's awesome. And I like it. I think we need to make some changes and shifts in how we redistrict. So I applaud this effort. Are there other states that have gone to this detail? This is significant. Are there other states that have gone to this level of detail in creating a redistricting advisory body, commission, and the focus and what you've done in this bill?
Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Nadeau, I really do appreciate the question, but I'm going to give you a very high-level answer, and then I'm going to ask that we move on because we do have a full agenda today, and I want to make sure that I touch the other answers, questions that people may have as well. The thing that I can say to you about this bill, and which I am very, very proud of being the lead author on this bill, is that we have looked in detail at what other states have done, what has worked, what has not worked. We have consulted experts from all across the nation, both liberal and conservatives, to say what is the best way to do this, keeping the voter and the citizen front and center. And that's what this bill does. It is not designed for us elected. It is designed for the citizens to be in control of who they get to vote for in the future. But I would be happy to share with you data and have a long, long-winded conversation with you after and to answer all of your questions more fully.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Cleborn, Section 6, starting on page 29, one of the criteria is minority representation. I think I have two questions here.
Could you please tell me which line of the bill you're referencing?
Yeah, I wanted to double check. Starting on line 30.16 to 30.18, can you clarify or maybe even just inform me what the intent is of those three lines, that the districts must provide racial minorities and language minorities to those who constitute less than voting age?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Koznick. So you're asking us for the definition of minority voting age? Is that what you're asking?
No. What is the intent of those three lines, the intent and the impact, please, Mr. Chair?
All right.
Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for that clarification, and I'll ask Mr. Hoffman to go into more detail about
Mr.
those
Hoffman.
Lines.
Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Koznick. That really is reflective of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which has specific requirements about ensuring that minority and minority language populations have adequate opportunity to elect representatives. So that is really codifying our adherence through redistricting with the Voting Rights Act.
Representative Koznick, follow-up?
Thank you. Yeah, if you could clarify, so it's less people that are less than voting age. Explain to me a little bit more in detail. So we're talking about people that are less than voting age, and you want to have more representation with that.
Mr. Hoffman?
I'm just going to briefly say this. When we are elected as representatives, right, we represent both people who are of voting age and those individuals who are not of voting age. We represent the entire community. So it is to ensure protection under the Voter Rights Act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Koznick.
Well, I'm not sure that the the author's answer addresses. I recognize I represent my kids and kids throughout our districts. But when we're talking about redistricting, I want to know how this impacts the redistricting.
Representative, maybe help you here. Our council here has some.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, so the sentence that you're referring to on page 30 is not about the age of the voters. It's about the whether the racial and language minorities constitute less than a majority of the district. So it's about the size of the group as opposed to the age of the group, if that makes sense.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think you've informed both the committee and the author. My second question is above that on lines 30.13 to 30.15, the district shall be drawn to protect the equal opportunity of racial, ethnic, and language minorities in the process to elect candidates of their choice. Can you discuss that?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick. I think that's the purpose of the entire bill, for citizens to be able to choose the electeds that best represent their community. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
I had a follow-up, Mr. Chair. This is quite consequential to the whole purpose of the bill, as the author had just stated.
Can you be short?
Well, I think it's this is a 45-page or
57-page
bill.
But you also understand.
Here's my point, Mr. Chair, and to the committee and to the author is, if I understand this right, and your intent is that you want to make sure that there's certain districts, if there's a racial minority population that is maybe a majority population, that those districts would be able to presumably elect a racial minority that in that district area. And so I understand that. So I think that's the intent. My concern is the opposite. Whereas I represent a majority white district, Hispanics are like the fourth highest population. And my district has chosen to elect a Hispanic.
That's awesome.
And I appreciate that of them, and I'm honored to have that representation. Does this portion of the bill, in fact, make it less likely in some instances that a minority would actually be elected in a district if otherwise for some of the priorities within this amendment, that would be harder for minorities to get elected if they're not the majority in their district?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, I think you've just proven the point of the bill. The idea is that the citizens of the community, the citizens of the state, the citizens of the region come together. They know their communities best. They know who works best in their community for them. And it is to not predetermine an outcome for the district. It is to allow the citizen commission to decide for themselves what the best districts look like. Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask you to be cognizant of time as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cleburne.
The question.
I'll just say thanks for working with the minority. I think when you were talking about, there's members of your party at the table, well, I think I'm the only one that was here as you were first working on this, and I served on the redistricting committee. And I'll just say this, and this should surprise nobody, I'm a pretty traditional person. I still believe that we as legislators should do our job and get past the partisan nonsensical fertilizer. I'll just make sure I'm keeping it nice for committee. We're charged to do this. And I sat in the redistricting committee, and neither side was successful in not being hyperpartisan. It was embarrassing. Both sides were political hacks. But I wish that we had done a better job, and I wish that we didn't have to have something like this. But I will say thank you for listening to the minority party and taking some of them. I think you took one of mine and one of Representative New Brindley's and some other ideas, which is in stark contrast to yesterday. when we heard that there was a fairly stiff-necked inflexibility on the other redistricting bill that was here before us. And I appreciate that this, we'll call it single-subject bill, because the other bill was way beyond that. Representative Kosnick reminds me of the term log rolling. So thanks for that. And thanks for being willing to be challenged and to try to do some different stuff, because we have strong feelings in different ways. I'm a very traditional person. I would like for the legislators to do our job as charged. It hasn't happened in forever, though. And it's in when we have full control over in one party, mixed government, whatever. We just can't figure this out. And I'm embarrassed by that. I think that we should do better. I am grateful, again, that we don't have to debate whether we're having a full-time professional political class rolled up into your bill, that we don't have to go down the road of that. Because, and I didn't bring any books today. I see the gratitude on your face. But I just think that if you're going to do this, and I'm not crazy about the idea, but if you're going to do this and the intent of the bill is to be fair and to bring all voices to the table in your redistricting effort, here's a concept. Let's involve the minority party in the crafting of your bill, which you have done. I'm still not crazy about it, and I'm still not there. And I have some ideas. One idea is, would you be open to making it so that if a person is on the commission for, let's say, the 2030 redistricting effort, that on the 2040 redistricting effort, that they might be precluded from being on there, just to keep a fresh supply of new voices coming in, just because so many people become the professional voice of this, and they may bring a particular agenda on both sides of the aisle. Could we make it so that we have people who are a fresh voice in that commission by precluding the previous person from serving on the board again? And I serve on many boards. I think you have too. There are clauses that say if you've served this many years or this many times on the board, they kick you off. I'm about to have that in next year in one of the boards I serve on, and I think that's not a bad idea. Would you be willing to put in something like that?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Lead Nash. I think it's a really good idea. And as you well know, Chair Murphy, as the chair of redistricting last year, was incredibly fair, nonpartisan, and I want to give her due credit for making sure that she brought minority voices and regional voices to the conversation of redistricting, and she was very careful to make sure that in the maps that she was responsible for, that those minority voices were upheld. And that's a conversation we can debate further elsewhere. But I think the question that I would like to close with is yours that you just asked. Yes, I would be open to that, and I'm also open to other ideas that your members have. The bill will be going to rules, and there's still time to make modifications. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll ask to close.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just very briefly.
Very briefly. Thank you, Representative Nash.
Let the record show that Chair Cleavorn said I had a good idea. but I again, I'm not there 100% with you, but I recognize the effort you put in and the fairness that you have gone down, and that it is not something that is going to create contention and a lot of frustration from both sides. Yesterday's bill, I would never, ever vote for. With some changes, I think there may be some Republican support for this, and I think that speaks to the level of effort that you put in.
Thank you, Lee Nash. And seeing no more discussion, Chair Cleavorn renews her motion to move 4593 to the Rules Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No. No.
The ayes have it. On to rules you go.
Sorry.
Thank you, members, for your work today. And we have a lot on the agenda, so we're going to be moving along pretty quickly now. Next up, we have Representative Freiberg's Bill 4182. This is my understanding that we're laying this bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Freiberg, you have the A3 amendment. Would you like to discuss the A3 amendment?
Sure. This makes some changes. This was also adopted as part of the Commerce Omnibus Bill. It makes some changes that address some of the concerns that have been raised. Specifically, it makes it clear that stacking of franchise fees by multiple units of government is not allowed. It makes it clear that the franchise fee applies only to broadband providers and not to wireless providers. It caps the franchise fee, and it prohibits fees inconsistent with the Federal Cable Act. So, yes, I would move the A3 amendment.
Are there any member questions? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg. Why are you carving out wireless providers away from cable providers? They both provide broadband, and I'm wondering why you're differentiating them.
Chair Freiberg.
The bill deals with internet providers. We want to keep it fairly limited at this point and not apply it to multiple entities.
Follow-up, Representative Nadeau.
And I'm sorry, I probably just don't understand. So wireless providers provide internet service, and so do wire providers, and I'm wondering why you're carving out one versus the other. I just don't understand.
Sure. Chair Freiberg.
If I could pass it to my, I have an expert here.
All right. If you would state your name for the record, and please proceed with your answer.
Morning, Chair and members. My name is Mike Bradley. I'm an attorney partner at Bradley Warner Law Firm. We're a law firm that represents local governments and state governments. Thank you for your question, Representative. The reason that wireless was excluded, they were excluded all along. This was to make it absolutely clear that they were excluded. The reason they were excluded is because the legislature passed special legislation for small cell and wireless. And excluded wireless from franchising.
Thank you. And Representative, to the amendment, are there any further questions to the amendment?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, seeing no further questions to the amendment, all those in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The amendment, the motion prevails and the A3 is adopted. Chair Freiberg, to your bill as amended.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the Equal Access to Broadband Act, which will provide digital equity statewide. Franchising agreements for private sector rental of the public right-of-way has a 40-year track record of assuring cable TV build-out to all residents and businesses. The Equal Access to Broadband Act will level the playing field with broadband ISPs while assuring build-out and minimum upload and download speeds to meet the current and future needs of the business and residents statewide. Each local government has unique needs for broadband deployment. This bill allows local officials the option to franchise broadband ISPs in the public right-of-way. As new providers enter or exit the marketplace, physically placing wires and equipment in the public space, local governments bear the cost of the and the responsibility of managing this scarce public asset for the various users of the right-of-way. As an essential service, broadband needs to be accountable at the local level and help pay for local needs and interests. Community television stations across the state rely on cable TV franchise fees and PEG fees to support coverage of government meetings, closed captioning, local news and events, high school sports, election coverage, information and education that allow residents to engage in their communities. This programming has become essential with the loss of local newspapers in many markets. We just heard about several more just today. While the programs are distributed on many digital platforms, franchise fees are paid only on decreasing traditional cable TV service. Franchising broadband ISPs would apply the same provisions as cable TV franchising, leveling the playing field. Several people signed up to testify in support of this bill, but we will just have two, not counting people who signed up independently, Shannon Slatton Schwartz from CCX Media and Mayor Dan Rowe of Roseville will be speaking. I do want to acknowledge the following people who were ready to testify in support, but out of respect for your time, we asked them not to. So that includes Mickey Kiefer of NDC4 in Dakota County, Ramsey Council Member Matt Westerhoff on behalf of QCTV, Xavier Vasquez of the St. Paul Neighborhood Network, Gretchen Sable of the League of Women Voters of Anoka, Blaine, and Coon Rapids, Jody Miller of the Northern Dakota Cable Commission, Karen George of QCTV, and Dave Kaiser of CCX Media. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Ms. Slatton. If you'll, Slatton Schwartz. If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good morning. Hello, everyone. My name is Shannon Slatton Schwartz with the Northwest Suburbs Cable Communication Commission and CCX Media. I am also proud today to represent MACTA, an organization that is strong with 135 local PEG stations and 838 cities across the state that receive franchising and local PEG. Organizations like mine produce unique programming that you do not see anywhere else. We fill a growing news desert, and we promote government transparency. Consider a city like Chaska, where I live, that uses PEG and franchising dollars to record city council meetings and produce community television. Their work will be even more important because of what happened yesterday, when the Chaska Herald, after 160 years of publication, announced their last day, their last paper will come out on April 25th. The same week that local papers in Chanhassen, Jordan, Shakopee, Prior Lake, Savage, Hutchison, and Litchfield will also cease to exist. Organizations like mine help fill that informational void. Not only do we record several city council meetings, but we also work with the League of Women Voters to produce nonpartisan forums. We produce high school sports and also unbiased news stories. I am very proud of a letter, or email actually, that we received just a few weeks ago that read, "Thank you for your factual and unemotional coverage of the Osseo Book Challenge. How refreshing in our time of outrage and divisive journalism. We are lucky to be able to trust CCX Media for honest coverage in our community. We win awards. The PEG stations with me today definitely do, but I'm more proud of a statement like that than I am anything else because it truly gets to the heart of what we do and why we do it. Something we don't talk about as often as we probably should is the advocacy that's outlined in our cable franchise agreement. Our phone number is still the only local number on the bill that residents can call for help. I took a call on Tuesday from a 75-year-old woman who lives in a Plymouth apartment. English is not her first language, and she just needed help with her services and her bill. She said she tried the 1-800 number, she tried the computer, so she called the 763 number, and we were able to connect her with our cable franchise partners and get the help that she needed. We have also been a watchdog, advocating for consumers on the national level. Cable commissions like mine were the only Minnesota governmental entities to file comments at the FCC advocating for all-in pricing to provide clarity for cable subscribers. And we were also the only Minnesota governmental entities to file comments at the FCC to support rules to prohibit digital discrimination. Franchising works, and it's important. It provides long-term protection for our residents and good quality information for our communities. Today and hopefully in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, we'll bring up Mr. Rowe, or Mayor Rowe. You'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Rowe, and I'm in my 14th year serving as the mayor of Roseville. For even longer than that, I have served on the as the city's representative on the board of the North Suburban Communications Commission, or NSCC, which is a municipal joint powers commission that franchises cable operators and operates our community media center for the 9 member cities, including Arden Hills, Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, Little Canada, Mounds View, New Brighton, North Oaks, and St. Anthony Village. On behalf of the city of Roseville, and the NSCC, and also concurring with the League of Minnesota Cities with their support, I'm pleased to testify in support of the Equal Access to Broadband Act. Through local cable franchising, Minnesota has an established record of protecting consumers and requiring uniform delivery of cable services to residents and providing an important public benefit through community media. We believe that local broadband franchising will replicate that success. An important aspect of franchise regulation is the ability to negotiate the build-out timing and coverage in the community, which is something that franchising affords local communities to do with local interests in mind. As has already been stated, public rights of way are a limited and valuable resource that local governments make available to private communications and utility companies to operate their businesses. I can tell you firsthand that the marketplace shift from cable services broadband services is increasing the burden on public rights of way and thus the value of their use, while at the same time decreasing cable franchise fee revenues to cities, as that is the only source of revenue through those franchise. The cable franchise fee revenue that is what funds that important regulatory effort as well as our community media centers. Community media remains a critical public resource, even more so as we experience the decline and disappearance of traditional sources of local news and information, as was just outlined this morning. Community media gives our citizens, in many cases, their only access to government activities, local events, including sports and performing arts, and other important local information, such as elections and candidate information on a nonpartisan basis. While these media offerings are still viewable on cable television, they are now increasingly streamed on broadband via broadband providers. The Equal Access to Broadband Act will modernize franchising to allow cities to franchise broadband companies and ensure all of our residents the same benefits with respect to broadband services that they currently receive as a result of cable franchising, including that important regulation as well as the provision of those local media services. The entities that I represent enthusiastically support this bill and ask that you adopt it. Thank you for your leadership in moving this legislation forward. Thank you, Chair, and for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mayor Rowe. Next, we will have Brent Christensen. Mr. Christensen will be followed by Melissa Wolf. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, or MTA. The MTA membership is a mix of cooperatives, family-owned, privately held, and publicly traded companies across throughout Minnesota. While MTA members have many different corporate structures, one thing we have in common is our commitment to serving Minnesota. Last year, MTA members invested just under $360 million in new and upgraded telecommunications infrastructure. This year, we estimate that they will invest just under $300 million. However, this bill puts that figure in doubt by taking investment decisions out of the hands of my members through the franchising process outlined in this bill. I'm here today to oppose House File 4182, and it's important for the committee to understand that no other state in the country has passed this type of legislation. And the reason is this bill is in direct violation of the Federal Internet Tax Freedom Act, or ITFA. The ITFA defines a tax as any charge imposed by any governmental entity for the purpose of generating revenues for governmental purposes and is not a fee imposed for a specific privilege, service, or benefit conferred. Further, we believe that there's federal case law that upholds the fact that this bill is proposing a tax and not a fee. As a monopoly service, cable franchising worked well in the 80s, but it doesn't work in a broadband world. Applying a cable-like franchise and taxing authority to other technologies 40-plus years later makes little sense. I have members that literally have to negotiate franchises with dozens of communities in their service footprint, and it will create different operating terms and conditions in different locations, as well as force uneconomic investments. The only winner will be the lawyers who represent cable franchising authorities who are paid by the hour. My members oppose this bill for a variety of other technical and policy reasons, but most importantly because it will increase consumer bills and harm low-income consumers. The added local government tax on consumers' broadband bill will tip the affordability scale in the wrong direction. Ironically, mayors of a number of Minnesota cities have recently written to the FCC to encourage it to continue the low-cost broadband programs, while at the same time their representatives are here today asking for an 8% tax on their residents' bills. Finally, this legislation is contrary to everything that the state of Minnesota, the legislature, the Office of Broadband Development, and my members are doing to see that all Minnesotans have access to quality broadband. You've heard testimony that's from supporters that this bill will bridge the digital divide by allowing local units of government to have build-out requirements as part of their franchises, when in fact it will have the opposite effect, most likely limiting investments in rural areas. Madam Chair, members, passing this legislation will create an untested regulatory scheme that risks upending the significant work that Minnesota has done since the establishment of the Governor's Broadband Task Force 15 years ago and the state's broadband grant program a decade ago. My members recognize this change occurring in the marketplace and is having a profound impact on cable television administrators. However, funding the decline of their revenues by taxing broadband services offered by my members is not the correct approach to solve this problem. I strongly urge you to oppose this bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much. If you'll take your seat now, if we need you, we'll call you back. Thank you so much. Next, we'll have Melissa Wolf, and she will be followed by Sarah Sick. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Melissa Wolf, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Minnesota Cable represents cable companies who are proud to serve residents of Minnesota in every corner of the state, from Schaumburg's and Thief River Falls to SCI in Hinckley and Midco in Fairmont. Collectively, Minnesota cable companies provide high-speed, reliable broadband connections to over 1.5 million residents in metro, suburbs, and rural Minnesota. Let me be clear, House File 4182 would stop Minnesota's progress toward universal broadband dead in its tracks and make broadband more expensive for citizens of this state. The bill authorizes a new 8% local tax on broadband and broadband-enabled services. This bill was touted as the Equal Access to Broadband Act. Don't be taken by that Orwellian title. None of the hundreds of millions of dollars that would be raised by this new broadband tax would further any cause that makes broadband more affordable or more accessible. The combined stacking effect of these new local broadband taxes will result in cost increases paid on to consumers on multiple services. These would be regressive taxes, hitting low-income and young consumers the hardest. In addition, this comes at a time when the Affordable Connectivity Program is coming to an end and Congress has unfortunately not reauthorized this program. While other states are looking to bridge this divide and keep access to internet more affordable, Minnesota is the only state looking to increase the cost of internet service. Minnesota cable members must already obtain a cable franchise and pay franchise and PEG fees that support PEG access programming. In 2023 alone, Minnesota cable members paid over $45 million in cable franchise and PEG fees to communities across the state. Contrary to how the amendment was described, this bill does violate federal laws and FCC rules, including the 621 or mixed-use rule that prohibits local governments from assessing duplicative franchise fees and from regulating cable broadband services. Courts have struck down local government attempts to franchise cable broadband services. Lastly, this bill picks winners and losers. Wireless and satellite providers are exempted under amendments added to the omnibus bill in the conference committee and today. Wireless and satellite customers will pay 8% less for broadband service. This kind of discrimination is not only unlawful, it also violates the Internet Tax Freedom Act. Minnesota has long been a leader in broadband development and accessibility. This bill takes us backwards. Minnesota should not be a broadband tax leader. Minnesota should be finishing the job of achieving universal broadband, not halting broadband deployment and widening the digital divide. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate you being here today. Welcome to the committee. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and Representative Freiberg. My name is Sarah Pasek, and I'm representing the Wireless Association, CTIA. And as you've heard, there has been an amendment that addressed several of our concerns, but it doesn't quite get to all of our concerns. So I am here to share a few more thoughts on the bill. So as you consider House File 4182, it's important to understand the already existing comprehensive federal regulatory construct governing wireless infrastructure deployment. It outlines both a host of public safety and deployment regulations that the wireless industry must follow, as well as protecting the important role of state and local governments, including their ability to recover costs associated with the management of rights of way. Unfortunately, this bill runs headlong into that construct, even with the A3 amendment designed to exempt wireless providers. As an example, the FCC has said explicitly that fees charged by localities for wireless infrastructure must be cost-based, specifically related to and caused by the deployment itself, and that localities cannot require a provider to pay a franchise fee to raise revenue as this bill does. This is just one of a number of examples in the bill that's clearly prohibited by the Federal Communications Act and FCC. Even though the bill was amended in an effort to exempt wireless providers, which we appreciate, the concept for a franchise fee for wireless has not historically existed. The nature of how wireless services are provided to consumers via both cell towers as well as small cell technology and how these services are treated under federal law differ significantly from cable providers. The language in HF 4182 is ambiguous and leaves unclear whether and how the bill's provisions would apply to the totality of services wireless providers offer. The best approach would be to instead or additionally define wireless services consistent with existing Minnesota law. So we further encourage further amendments, or we strongly encourage further amendments to House File 4182 to provide a clear and comprehensive exemption for wireless. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your being here and for your comments. I do not have anyone else listed as tester. If you'd like to come forward, please. And I'd like to remind the members that the microphones are very sensitive and we want to make sure that we can hear the speakers on the audio recording. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. We are a research and education organization supporting sound tax policy and efficient, accountable, fiscally responsible government. I appreciate the opportunity to offer some thoughts today on House File 4182, specifically the proposed franchise fee to broadband service providers. My comments will focus specifically on the tax policy and public finance issues presented by this proposal. The term franchise fee, notwithstanding, these fees function like taxes. The objective of a tax is to raise general revenue, as opposed to a fee which covers the cost of provided government service to an individual. House File 4182 identifies raised revenue as the first justification for its authorization, and the second justification is used is to defray increased municipal costs that accrue as a result of right-of-way occupation. There's also clear interest in using these revenues to support public information and education on community affairs in light of declining public education government fees, or PEG fees, associated with cable services. It's fair to say an intent to dedicate tax is probably the most accurate way to describe this proposal. The important tax policy question that arises is whether these broadband fees revenues would be used for these purposes or be used to support general government operations, much like an unrestricted sales tax. A study published in the Journal of Information Policy entitled Exploring the Policy Value of Cable Franchise and PEG Fees examined the 20 largest cities in the United States to study the collection and use of these fees. Researchers examined each city's municipal budget and various secondary sources to determine how much franchise and PEG fee revenue actually went to cable-related administrative infrastructure and PEG-related expenses. Very conservatively, they identified $188 million in unaccounted revenue in these 20 cities, cable franchise and PEG revenue that could not be linked to PEG-related cable infrastructure or related administrative expenditures. While acknowledging the importance of access to local information and its vital role in facilitating greater civic engagement and political participation, the research concluded there is scant evidence that this revenue is used to defray costs associated with cable-related allocations with any regularity, and the bulk of the proceeds are absorbed by general operating budgets. Now, undoubtedly, some resources would be directed to the intended policy uses described here today. However, as this study indicates, these fees also serve as revenue diversification, generating large but highly variable amounts of fungible revenue for local governments. As a result, state equalization efforts would be significantly exacerbated, complicated, and challenged. And I think it's important to recognize in conclusion that equalization concerns have been the basis of objections to similar revenue diversification proposals like general local sales tax authority, and is the policy reason for spending hundreds of millions of dollars each year in local government aid. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Since I'm looking around the room, looking to see if anyone else wants to testify, I would like to remind the audience that is here, we do have a policy that people need to be seated during committee. So if you are not a House staff individual, I'm going to ask you to please take a seat in the committee room. It's for your security and everyone else. Thank you very much. Members, I want to remind you before we move to member questions that this bill is being laid over and we do have a full agenda. I'm sure that Representative Freiberg would be happy to address your concerns at any time before this bill would move forward. Lead Nash.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to make sure that none of my members had questions. I believe Representative Joy did first. So
I didn't see any hands. Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, coming from a current situation of being a mayor of a small city, you know, we worked really good with our internet providers. For a long time, we had one company, and then we brought another company in. And when we brought it through the city, we worked, you know, they came in and did it right, and we worked on where we should put it through town and make sure we don't interrupt all our other utilities that we own, like natural gas, all that. Now we're looking at putting more tax on the people in my communities. And, you know, again, I don't understand where this is a good process for us to do. When people are hurting today, we're going to add a franchise fee or whatever we want to call it. It's just adding more fees to the people in the communities. You know, and I guess my question is why this? I mean, I know the cable franchise, we can talk about the newspapers going away. Most people get their newspaper online nowadays. And it seems like we're picking winners and losers here. And I don't understand why we're thinking this is good to tax something. You know, and I'm fortunate enough to sit on the tax committee. And one thing we're talking about, how people are hurting right now, we're trying to create child tax credits, everything we're doing. But yet now we're turning around and we're going to add more fees to people. I don't understand why we're taking from one end but then adding in the other end. For me, it's very hard to understand this bill at all.
Representative Joy, could you please be more concise about the question? I'm trying to follow the question.
Sure.
Thank you.
First of all, why more tax? Representative Freiberg.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Joy. This is comparable to what we do for cable. There is a long history with cable franchising, and this just would apply that to broadband. I'm glad to hear you have your city has a good relationship with your internet provider. To me, that sounds like a situation where a city might not need to adopt a franchise fee because this is just an option for cities.
So this,
Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. So this is an opt-in or opt-out for cities. They do not have to follow this law.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Joy. I draw your attention to line 3.14 of the bill. It says the amendment changed the language a bit. I think with the amendment it reads a local franchising authority may. I would just draw your attention to that word may on line 3.14. That does not change with the amendment. But the local franchising authority may require a provider furnishing broadband within the jurisdiction to obtain a franchise.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to ask you to please be concise with your question.
Yes, I will do my very best.
Thank you so much.
Representative Freiberg, you mentioned in your opening comments that, you know, that this would help offset the costs that municipalities have in maintaining utility infrastructure. Can you explain to me what those costs a municipality would incur when a utility comes up, be it electric, cable, gas, as they've taken that right of way from a private landowner, and it's there for the common good. Those utilities are owned by the providers, be it electric, gas, or cable. Can you explain to me what costs a municipality might incur in maintaining that infrastructure?
And are you speaking to the infrastructure in the bill? Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, I'll just so I can make sure that I'm on track here, it's 3.21.
Thank you.
Line 3.21, defray increased municipal costs that accrue as a result of right-of-way occupation.
Thank you so much, Representative Nadeau. I appreciate that. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Yeah, there are costs to, you know, burying cable and broadband lines, as well as repairing the road. I mean, this is a public entity. This is essentially like a lease or rent to by a public entity, a government-owned entity, to a people-owned entity to a private company. So it's kind of similar. It can be kind of similar to a rent, a payment, too, you could think of. But Mr. Bradley can maybe speak to it, provide more concrete
sure.
examples.
Mr. Bradley.
Chair and Representative Nadeau, thank you for the question. This is exactly how we treat existing utilities and cable operators. All utilities, and except for phone companies, all utilities and franchise, or excuse me, and cable companies are required to get franchises. And they pay a franchise fee, and it's consideration for use of the public right of way.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so it's really not to defray increased municipal costs that accrue as a result of right-of-way occupation. It's a rent payment. It's a contract that a city, some political subdivision that says, my residents need electricity, and in order for you to bring in electricity, we're going to charge you rent to utilize space in a public right-of-way that everybody gets to use. Is that fair? My question specifically is regarding 3.21, to defray increased municipal costs that accrue as a result of right-of-way occupation.
That's what the language of the bill says. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Mr. Bradley?
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, that is part of what that section says, but it also says it is to, one, raise revenue, two, defray increased municipal costs, or three, both. So the franchise fee is the rental for the use of the right-of-way. It will also be, the fee will also be used for the continued support of access television, which has been typically paid for through cable fees. And as you all know, cable television service is rapidly declining and all shifting over to broadband now.
And Representative Nadeau, did you have one last follow-up?
Yep, this is my last thing. So, and I'm glad that you bring up the first part of line 3.21. It's raise revenue. So if that's what we're doing, and increased public, you know, educational and government television, you know, we have other ways to do that other than burying the costs. And I think there was a lot of testimony up here that talked about the amount of these franchise fees that are going to that is relatively insignificant compared to what's being raised. There's a franchise fee in my community, and it's a per meter fee. And, you know, every month I get a bill for every one of my meters. I have two of them, and it's $9 or something cents that the city gets to collect. The electric utility collects that money on behalf of the city, and then that money then every month is returned to the municipality, which is another franchise fee. I mean, in Hennepin County, we've got an organic fee. It's not a fee, it's a tax, and that's exactly what this is, and I think that's what the testifiers were testifying to. A fee has an associated cost that's being borne, and this is a tax. And if we go down to line 3.23, that sum of money based on the gross operating revenues or gross earnings resulting from the provider's operations, that's not a fee. This is a tax. And there's other ways that local units of government should raise revenue to pay for services. And I think this thing needs a ton of work. I mean, no other state has it. If it truly violates federal law, it's dead to begin with. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Nadeau. Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm starting, if Ms. Wolf could come back, I do have a question for that testifier.
Ms. Wolf.
And thank you, Madam Chair. As she's coming down, Representative Nadeau just stole a lot of what I was going to say, so I won't duplicate that. But some of us have municipal government experience. Whenever we would talk about franchise fees at the city that I served in, it was always explained this is a tax. But the thing that I have, the question for Ms. Wolf is, Madam Chair, is Ms. Wolf, upon whose documentation or monthly bill does this tax get reflected?
I'm going to ask you to be concise in your answer because we are going to wrap this bill up very shortly.
Sure.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. So this, if I, sorry, understand your question correctly, this goes directly to a customer's bill.
And Madam Chair.
Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's the whole confusion is, let's say that this is the monthly bill that I get from my provider. At the bottom of that bill is this franchise fee. And it's very confusing for people who receive that, like, why is my service provider screwing me with this new fee? Why, I'm confused. It's going to the city, and it's a tax, and it's misrepresented, and there's no nuanced way to, on a bill, say, P.S., by the way, this is your city doing this to you, not the franchisee. I think that's a problem. I will thank you, Ms. Wolf. I will point out also that Representative Nadeau and others and Representative Joy pointed out that of the 8% possible to be collected, 5% could go to anything, slush fund for the city. And it's going to prop up its general fund, and that's in the bill. Problem with that is you're not actually incurring an actual cost, and it says, as you were just talking about, on line 3.21, raise revenue. Stop. Raise revenue for the city of pick a place. And what that's going to wind up doing is it's going to find a way to bury that fee, that tax, so that the city council members don't have to vote to possibly raise the levy at the end of every year. And for those of us that have done that, those truth and taxation meetings kind of suck, because you wind up having to hear from people who you're going to blast with this new tax. And fortunately, when I was mayor, we lowered taxes in the city of Waconia, so that was great. But, Madam Chair, the notable piece of information, I think the case was City of Eugene versus the FCC, where this was completely bounced out. This was thrown out as unconstitutional. I don't know why we're wasting our committee's time with something that's really, as Representative Doe said, dead on arrival. You're creating an opportunity also to impact with the subsidy of the $30 federal subsidy ending, I think it's this month. So you're going to take the $30 away because the feds didn't renew that. And now you lose the $30 when you live in outstate Minnesota. And, hey, we've got a deal for you. We're going to add on a whole new franchise fee and stick it to you yet again. And I'm glad this bill is being laid over. Otherwise, I would vote no as many times as possible, Madam Chair. And one small request, Madam Chair, when you engrossed the amendment, you asked for the yeas, but then you banged the gavel before you could actually ask for the noes.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
Because we're process people.
Thank you.
We do relish the opportunity to vote no.
I do appreciate that. And so I will call the vote again for the A3 if you need me to.
No need.
All right, thank you.
You had the votes, but I'm just asking as a courtesy.
Totally missed that.
Sometimes the voice of the minority would like to be heard on votes.
I appreciate the relationship that we have and that you're never afraid of correcting my errors. I love it. With that, I'm going to ask you, Chair Freiberg, we are laying the bill over. If you would, we are laying the bill as amended over. So if you would please just give your closing comments.
Sure, thank you. This is a really important bill, and there's a lot of misinformation out there related to this bill. There were several inaccuracies related to the references to the federal lawsuit. We actually have a litigator from that case here who could describe the case in great, exhaustive detail.
No, thank you.
But out of respect for members' time, I will not ask him to do that right now. You know, one cost that hasn't been discussed is the cost to local governments for negotiating build out to underserved communities. And that's a really important part of this bill. You know, just making sure that, because there are areas within communities that don't have reliable access to broadband, and through this mechanism, cities can help ensure that they do. You know, internet providers, you know, and there's also, I think, some misplacement in terms of the discussion related to it. The internet providers tack on additional fees that are of dubious merit. I'm glad we have other litigation that addresses those fees moving through the Commerce Committee. Suffice it to say, I think this fills an important community need. I appreciate members' time and look forward to working with members as this moves forward.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Next, the bill is laid over. Next, we will have House File 4757, Representative Stevenson. Chair Stevenson. Again, I'm going to ask anyone who's entered the room since my last announcement, if you are not a member of House staff, please take a seat. Chair Stevenson, since you're not a member of this committee, I'm going to move that House File 4757 be re-referred to the Health Committee. If you would quickly tell us about your bill, and then we'll call the three testifiers that we have listed forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 4757 is this year's cannabis omnibus bill, making a series of tweaks and changes to the cannabis bill that passed last year. There's a number of changes in the bill. In the interest of time, I will focus on those that are within the jurisdiction of this committee, but I'm very happy to talk to members at any time about any provision that's in the bill. Section 36 authorizes the director of the Office of Campus Management to employ deputy directors, apply for and accept grants, apply for and receive federal money, and make contracts. And then sections 45 and 56 have to do with OCM's interactions with local governments. Section 45 makes changes to how we verify that cannabis businesses are meeting local zoning ordinances. It says that a business can't receive an endorsement without if they aren't in compliance with local zoning ordinances. The endorsement under this new configuration is the last step before the business can start operations. So that's a key thing to make sure that people are in compliance before they can actually start operation. Section 56 makes modifications to the local registration enforcement section. Probably the most significant change is we had contemplated last year asking local cities to do compliance checks to make sure that the products that are sold in these businesses were lawful. OCM is making the argument that I think is pretty compelling that that's probably a task better suited for the agency than for local units of governments, because there are so many products, and determining what is lawful and what's not is probably not something that we should ask cities to do. It should be something that the agency does. The last section that I'll draw members' attention to is at the tail end of the bill, section 115. It transfers the Office of Medical Cannabis to the Office of Cannabis Management. This was always contemplated. We're just moving up the date that it happens.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. And I know this bill has been back and forth many times, and so I appreciate your being with us today to discuss this matter. We do have testifiers who are scheduled for today. The first testifier that we have is Charlene Brenner. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
It's all right. Technology is technology.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. For the record, my name is Charlene Briner, and I'm currently serving as the Interim Director of the Office of Cannabis Management. And I want to thank this committee and you, Madam Chair, as well as Representative Stevenson, for the opportunity to present the proposals that fall under your jurisdiction to this committee. As I said, and as Chair Representative Stevenson said, we want to make sure that we are focusing specifically on those proposals that fall under your purview. We have used two primary lenses as we do all of our implementation work. What do we need to do to launch in an effective and timely manner, and what do we need to regulate effectively over time? And the proposals you'll hear today fall directly into that focus. So you will see, as Representative Stevenson mentioned, there are two primary buckets that we have grouped our proposals in that fall under the State and Local Government Committee, changes to the office structure, and improvements to the application and licensing process. I would like to spend a little time talking specifically about the components of our recommendations to modify the structure of the office. Chapter 342 already contemplates and plans for the transition of the hemp-derived enforcement from the Office of Medical Cannabis to the department that operates at the Department of Health to the Office of Cannabis Management. We recommend accelerating this transition to move the hemp-derived enforcement authority to OCM on July 1st of this year. Several sections of the bill address this proposal through multiple references and transfer language, including supporting access to data that will inform our licensing and enforcement decisions and provide the protections for the employees who are currently doing the work at another agency as they transfer to OCM. This change actually allows for an earlier integration of our multiple enforcement activities and inspection staff, continuity of operations, and consistency in our enforcement of regulations of all things cannabis. By amending 15172 directly, we keep the current temporary regulation in place as the licensing structure at OCM continues to be built out. And then later, once we have adopted our rules, the hemp-derived product and enforcement will transition to Chapter 342, the enforcement and licensing structure in 342. Additionally, we recommend modifying the structure of the office by replacing references to the Division of Medical Cannabis and replacing those two references to the office, meaning the Office of Cannabis Management. The plan is to fully retain the medical program and ensure continuity for the people who depend on the products, the medicine, and also provide continuity for the people doing this work, while also giving OCM the authority to do that work in totality in order to maximize our capacity and effectiveness. This structure modification is included in several sections throughout the bill. And then finally, OCM is recommending amending the authority of the director, as Representative Stevenson mentioned, to align with that of other state agencies. These changes grant the authority to make appointments, to establish deputies, to leverage outside and federal funds that may be available, and provide for administrative authority under the director. These changes really align the office, as I mentioned, with the authorities of other state agencies, and it will allow the person who succeeds me in this role to actually operate and lead the agency with the high standards of effectiveness that we expect from all state agencies serving Minnesotans.
Thank you very much.
One more. I'm going to go really quickly. Improvements to the application and licensing process, as Representative Stevenson mentioned, this is a very important provision that we think is important for you to understand. As we previewed in a report to the legislature several months ago, we recommend changes to the application process that really changes the order of operations. As part of our efforts to stand this up effectively, we want to make sure that we have clarity in the process for all applicants, and as well as clarity for our local partners who are critical to launching and regulating cannabis effectively in all municipalities throughout the state. Right now, the first step for somebody who's applying for a license is to come to OCM. The first step is contemplated to go to the local government. But the local governments are asked to provide subjective narrative without any assurance or information about whether an applicant is on track to obtain a license. This creates the risk of a sort of who's on first confusing process in which local governments are operating without any information about the viability of a candidate or whether or not they're on track to obtain a license. OCM proposes changing that order of operations so that the first stop is OCM, where we do our due diligence. We vet the applicants for viability and requirements that exist in Chapter 342. Once we have conducted that and they have been selected to continue on the licensing process, they will go to the local government, who will do their own review to ensure for compliance with, and they get their local zoning and other local ordinance approvals. Then, and only then, if they meet all local ordinance approvals, they will come back to OCM through an integrated application and licensing system where we issue final endorsement to go ahead and begin business operations. By clarifying this order of operations, we make the process easier, less confusing, we give better information to local governments, and we also have a more integrated application and licensing process. I want to be respectful of your time, Madam Chair, so I am going to speed through and just highlight that we are also doing some improvements to the application and licensing process. I think that I actually went through that without even advancing my slides, so I'm going to stop and am happy to take questions or turn it back over to Representative Stevenson.
I greatly appreciate your work, your time, and your testimony, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we have, oops, I just lost my own agenda. We have Sean Tatro. And then next we will have Amber Shrimpa. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, ma'am and Madam Chair and members. My name is Sean Tatro. I represent King Kind Cultivation. I'm here to speak on the need for cannabis cultivation businesses to work with their local government and the long lead times required to become operational. Local approval is difficult to attain, especially for a cultivation. With little to no large-scale facilities available, a company will need to work with cities on either a massive rehab or a ground-up construction. The capital this requires is immense, and complying with city zoning laws will be required. House File 100 was originally written to require a location for operations. For us, finding a city willing to house a 75,000 square foot building that can house a 30,000 square foot canopy and supporting rooms was no small feat. We were lucky to find a city to work with us and are proud to say we are close to obtaining permits to break ground on our new construction project. To become fully operational, lead times could take up to 2 years, and there is a large amount of capital required. If cultivators don't get to work soon, there won't be cannabis for the supply chain. Newly licensed operators, along with the cannabis market, are bound to fail without a steady and abundant supply. A successful statewide rollout will require an immense amount of canopy ready for cultivation. Indoor facilities have many specific demands, such as access to adequate utilities, building layout, ceiling heights, and environmental planning. Businesses that have completed many of these steps will be able to meet demand in the shortest amount of time. Distributing licenses to cultivators with the shortest lead times to operation will be the most efficient route to a functioning recreational market. I've been in this industry for 28 years and am willing to work with the OCM or any legislators interested in a Minnesota resident entrepreneur's perspective. Creating a successful cannabis market would be a feather in all of our caps. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Amber Shimpa, and I am the CEO of Vireo Health of Minnesota, one of Minnesota's medical cannabis licensees. I was personally present on July 1st of 2015 when we served Minnesota's first medical patients. And for the past 10 years, it's been an honor to continue to lead and serve over 55,000 Minnesotans in the medical program. I am proud of the way we've supported my home state with our community partners. We have advanced medical research, supported expungement and clemency efforts, and we have a 9-year track record providing jobs for hundreds of Minnesotans and supporting labor peace under a CBA with the local UFCW 1189. We applaud the work that went into crafting last year's adult use bill and into laying the initial groundwork for the launch of adult use sales. This bill contained many common sense outcomes, streamlining efforts for expungement of nonviolent offenses, generous home grow and possession limits, and the creation of a medical combo license, which allows up to 90,000 square feet of cultivation capacity. Achieving a successful rollout of the adult use program is a challenging undertaking, and we have seen programs fail when the process begins to pit applicants and stakeholders against each other. Our shared responsibility as stewards of cannabis in Minnesota is to be stronger together. This is not a zero-sum game or winner-takes-all. A successful industry depends upon folks both competing and working together on a robust supply chain. This supports good business, good product safety, and brings consumers to a regulated and taxed market. The demand for cannabis in Minnesota will be large enough to enable success at every level of the supply chain. But a minimally viable market launch with a slow or tiered issuance of licenses and an inefficient supply chain will put a successful program implementation at risk. Establishing licensing timelines for all license types now will provide all applicants the visibility needed to ensure success in the market. Consumers want access to quality products at affordable prices, and making sure supply is adequate to meet this demand is crucial to curbing the illicit market, supporting public safety, and generating tax revenue. Unfortunately, last year's bill lacks a clear path to ensuring continuity of access for medical patients. For some patients, medical cannabis is a vital component of managing symptoms and living a fulfilling life. A responsible rollout in Minnesota must ensure that medical patients can continue accessing the products they rely on. Existing medical operators like Vireo are already experienced with the unique demands of the regulated cannabis markets, leaning on our experience and operations while also supporting smaller businesses and social equity applicants will ensure adequate supply to meet consumer demands and prevent the illicit market from thriving. This will allow continuity for medical patients, enable success for small businesses and social equity applications, and protect hundreds of existing Minnesota jobs. Minnesotans deserve to have choices in their cannabis industry, and a responsible, common sense rollout that fully utilizes all available infrastructure can and should be part of this program's implementation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you for the service to the 55,000 Minnesotans you serve. Thank you. Okay, that is everyone who has signed up in advance. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on this bill and related to the sections of this jurisdiction? So if you would like to come forward, please come forward. And I'm going to ask you to keep your testimony to 2 minutes or less, please. Okay, so we have two. Please come forward, and when you're ready, if you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Hello, Ms. Chair and board members. I'm Chris Moon, CEO of King Kind Cultivation. I was born and raised here in Minnesota. This is my home. I'm here to convey the importance of support and approval from local officials regarding cannabis cultivation. As a cannabis professional, this isn't something I want to do to my community. It's something I want to do with and for my community. For the people it'll help, jobs it will create, and revenue it will bring. I'm here to be of service and take great pride in that. Conversely, I couldn't do this alone or without the support of my community and its officials. Indeed, our first step was to reach out to local communities to learn who might welcome our business. You see, larger cultivation facilities have very specific needs, and local involvement is imperative to meet those unique demands. Our operations would prove difficult to downright impossible without it. The HF 100 gave a level of control to local government, and I believe that's very reasonable, considering all our work encompasses. My team called communities across Minnesota for months to speak with officials and ask for permission. It took a lot of time to build that bridge, but through abundant communication and many meetings, a consenting relationship was formed. I can't fathom how we'd have done any of this without the assistance of local authorities. Operators that have located city are fortunate when so many initially shut their doors to our industry. And Minnesota is so much closer to creating a safe recreational cannabis market due to that teamwork. Indeed, it'll be the main reason there's legal product in the supply chain at all in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And members, we're going to take a break in just a few minutes, but I just want to just a 5 minute break. But if you would please can state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Hello. sorry. I'm John Barty. Thank you. And thank you all. I represent the Cannabis Retailers and Manufacturers Association. I kind of just want to emphasize everything the other testifiers have said. We have a strong THC community here in Minnesota that has been very active since 2022. And many, many entrepreneurs started getting ready last August. They have made those connections with their cities. They have found where they want to do their operations. And we really do need to lean on the infrastructure that is existing in the states, or get those guys in and use what we have here as we build out the rest of the program. So I just want to emphasize everything they've said, especially on the cultivation side. That is where the rest of our industry will come from. So we need to make sure that we have them set up right. Thank you.
Thank you. And I appreciate your comment about the cultivation. Members, we are at 10:10, which is the normal time for a committee to end.
I would like to know, I would like to be able to wrap this bill up quickly because we only want to address the sections that are important to us and then take a break. I don't know how many members have questions, so.
I'll be quick.
Okay, if I can ask you to keep them really short and then we'll take a break. Representative Nadeau.
Thanks, Representative Cleburne. Thanks, Representative Stevenson. So in the section, in section 56, in light of the conversation we've just had here kind of regarding franchise fees, I know that we're not, you're not changing anything. I'm not asking about that other than I'm wondering, and I like this, that you're eliminating, wait a second. Ken was reading that. You're eliminating that a retailer and with a medical license and a retail license can only, you're eliminating the fact that it can only be charged one fee. I'm just curious as to why you're doing that.
Chair Stevenson.
It's line 57.15. Sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, it's because we eliminated the medical cannabis retailer license altogether.
Ah, okay.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau?
Yep, and just my follow-up was had to do with the presentation that was put on regarding the integrated, that plan for integrated licensing requirement. So when somebody goes in to get a retail license, they're going to start with the office, and then they're going to go to the city. And at that point, they're going to make an application, pay the permit fee. It kind of starts that 60-day clock of they either have to approve or disapprove. What have the integrated part? I kind of like. I mean, it's a little bit confusing because there's so many people involved. But have you addressed that? And I know that cities have the ability to extend that 60 days. But have you talked to cities to make sure that that's not going to be a hindrance to getting these facilities licensed?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, I know we had extensive conversations last year with the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties about the amount of input that they wanted versus the amount of input that we could give and striking that balance. This is a slight tweak to the order of operations there with leaving the substance largely untouched. We haven't had as extensive conversations with them this year because I think the heavy lifting was done last year.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Representative Kosnick, if you can be brief, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. A couple questions for municipalities, and we were attempting to have an amendment provided, but maybe we can just have this, some discussion. And that is some of the cities, and last year when we were in this committee, we were rushed on time too. I believe the cities only had about 90 seconds if we go back to the tape, but I appreciate if the author could just give us some guidance, a little bit of what your thoughts or intentions would be. Many municipalities are interested in having a little bit more control in their cities or towns of the retail aspect of it, and they would like to apply for the municipal license and have some priority over the lottery system in that. Is that something that you might be open to? Because I don't know that that's necessarily addressed in this bill, but I know there's some discussion around the Capitol about that. What are your thoughts on that, Representative Stevenson?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, so the bill last year did authorize cities to have municipal cannabis stores. I know there's a number of cities that are interested in doing that. Of course, in the municipal liquor context, you can have exclusivity along with having a municipal liquor store, and we don't do that in this bill. And at this point, I'd probably oppose to exclusivity. But I heard you ask about priority, which is different, saying they should move to the front of the line for that jurisdiction. It's a conversation that I'm open to having. I'm not saying I would accept that, but I'd be willing to talk to folks about it.
Okay. Follow up?
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. Representative Stevenson, I think that is a conversation that we want to continue to have. Whether you call it priority or maybe a dual track, it's not the intention of the cities that I've talked to bump other people out of an opportunity for that, but it's something that they feel helps provide the control that they want within their jurisdiction. The other question was about selling, in other instances, other states, the social equity applicants have applied, been granted a license opportunity with no intention of necessarily holding on to that and kind of flipping it for profit to other larger retailers, probably nationwide retailers, bigger corporations. Is that something that's on your radar to try to limit, or maybe you are in support of it? And maybe one way to do that, I might suggest, is to eliminate the cap on licenses and just let the market work itself out, and those that are good at providing retail or good at providing wholesale, good at providing services to their customers, and then just not have this secondary market of license flipping and selling.
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kosnick. So last, under the law that passed last year, a license held by a social equity applicant could only be transferred to another social equity applicant. And you can look at Section 43, which is on page 39 of the bill, to see that. We actually are loosening that this year. So the answer to your question is yes, that is a phenomena that we were concerned about, sort of the straw purchaser, to borrow a term from a different context. And the bill last year took
I'll buy you lunch if you use the term logro.
Excuse me.
Very strong line on that last year, saying social equity applicants can only give to other social equity applicants. That's actually problematic, though, because part of the goal here is to allow communities that have not done well to build wealth and do other things. And if you can't ever sell your business, you have a problem there. So if you look at the new language that's being added in that section, now we're saying that you can only transfer social equity applicant to social equity applicant for the first 3 years, yep. And then after that it's loosened up. So that's the balance that we're trying to meet between the problem that you raise and then the need to let people build wealth and grow their business and transfer it.
Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kosnick asked a lot of the questions that I was going to ask, but Chair Stevenson, the question that I have is the vetting process on the front end. How do you verify their liquidity, knowing, to kind of piggyback off what Representative Kosnick just said, if you have a social equity applicant that meets many of the criterion but doesn't meet the fiscal criterion and the liquidity criterion, how do you take care of that? Because, you know, we've had some stumblings in the office already from its inception, and I don't want to create an opportunity where we're having other big problems, particularly with that particular licensure.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, since the question is how the agency would operate, so I think that might be a good question for the agency to answer.
Interim Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee Nash. We will be doing due diligence according to the criteria in 342, and specifically to the liquidity and the viability of the candidates. We'll be reviewing their business plans, their statements, their partnership agreements, and all of the things that are specified in 342. So we'll be doing that due diligence on the front end, which actually gives more information to the locals when they're making their decisions about the viability of the applicants in front of them.
Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then last question. Can you give us to the interim director, can you give us an update on where revenues are versus what was expected already, just to give us kind of an understanding of that?
Interim director, if you don't have that information available, you can provide it to the committee at a later time.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Lead Nash. I think that we would, because I'm not quite tracking that question, so we would
follow up offline.
Happy to follow up with you.
Thank you very much. Any further question, Lead Nash?
We'll keep moving on. I think that this is a work in progress. I know that many of us still have problems with how it's operating and working and so on, but we'll in the interest of the chair's desire to move on, we'll just keep going.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4757 be re-referred to the Health Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 4757 is re-referred to the Health Committee. Thank you. Members, we're going to take a five-minute break, let people stretch their legs and move, take care of their needs, and then we will reconvene. We are in recess.
Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah. I didn't see it when it came in. Thank you. So, see, this goes only by.
Thank you, Michael.
I'll put the last two bills.
the last four.
So it looks like everything's way over.
Yep, Pinto's the only one we have to worry about.
It's confusing. I was like looking up thinking, what?
I was going to stick around for Pinto's bill, but I'm not going to do that anymore because I've been here for a very long time. And I think that one will be fine. I'll watch from home.
We're going to turn off the mics just for now.
where that
goes. You know what it is? Exactly. Our researchers had it right in my line of sight.
Is that what it is?
And I can't see it. Yeah. We'll explain to the researchers.
I think I should move to the end of the day. So you probably don't know where this is.
I do know that.
And so I sit down there so I can see your...
You know, it's you.
Yeah, I can see.
But that's why I'm always looking around.
You got your coffee, you don't need anything.
No, you sit where
you're at. Danny?
Yeah.
Our social flavors.
I understand you're going to be doing an amendment on the optometrist bill to include the shots that they put in the eye.
Start first.
In front of the eye.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yep. It's going to take a little while.
I'm going to support that. And
can I please ask anyone in the audience to please take a seat? I shouldn't say audience. In the public space, to please take a seat. Members, if you're ready to begin, I appreciate the bipartisan display of support for each other that I'm seeing in the room. Okay. We have several schedules today that we are trying to balance, so we are going to move on to House File 4748. Representative Bonner, if you would please, this bill will be laid over. That is our intention. So if you'd please describe the bill and yes, go ahead.
And first, thank you. I say thank you to Chair Pinto for allowing us to switch it up just a little bit and accommodate. Last year, we made a series of updates to the Minnesota Enabling Statute, Chapter 16E, which was first enacted in the 90s. It represented the technology perspectives of that time and contained a significant number of provisions that predate the minute consolidation of 2011. Last year's work removed or updated outdated references and terms, clarified responsibilities to better align with the mission of Minute, and reorganized it for clarity. In essence, we cleaned up and modernized the statute to align with the current roles, process, best practice, and current expectations. This bill continues that modernization effort and remedies some of the technology concepts that don't align with the way Minute collaborates with our business partners to deliver digital services. It removes outdated sections of statute that predate the Minute consolidation that no longer apply, which create conflicts in existing law and current business practice. I will provide a brief high-level summary of the key concept of project versus initiative to provide clarity for members, as all of the other changes sort of flow from that central concept. So first, Minute's current statute contains about 80 mentions of the word project and resulting authority that requirements that relate to how Minute works with state agency partners to ensure the delivery of digital services. While instrumental in today's technology industry, the term project carries a very specific and in some cases a little bit outdated view of working to deliver new functionality, systems, and technology fixes. As many of you know, I have been an evangelist pushing our agency partners to adopt more efficient, agile, people-centered design to create better results faster and more cost-effectively. These changes also better align process and funding mechanisms. Minute, our business partners, and the Technology Advisory Council are laser-focused on successful delivery of IT projects, including more modern ways of working. In fact, we have won several awards for some of our work in this field. Minnesota is leading. The bill here today specifically takes a long-term view of maintaining critical assets rather than one-time project-based view, which doesn't accurately reflect the reality of modern IT systems. The bill replaces outdated terms with initiatives where requirements related to the project appear and support this more modern service delivery model while keeping the spirit of the existing policies in place. I appreciate that for many of my colleagues, this gets a little bit down into the weeds on how we deliver IT services for the modern era. And with the exception of Lead Nash, probably a bit of a snooze fest for some of us in this room. But rest assured, the changes will benefit our agencies and Minnesotans. First of all, I also want to mention that this bill has the support of MINIT and the Governor's Technical Advisory Council on IT, a public-private partnership, which includes myself, Lead Nash, and Representative Elkins in the House, Senators Wicklund, Curran, Zhang, and Lucero in the Senate, giving this bill a bit of a bipartisan support in both chambers. And with that, I would ask you to support House File 4748. And with that, I do have here today Brandon from the MINIT Services to help answer any in-depth questions on the specifics of the bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions, member questions?
Madam Chair, I'll just say that this is a bipartisan effort. It is supported by all members, and we can probably just move on since we don't really need to ask a ton of questions.
Okay. Any other questions from our side of the table? All right, seeing none, I will just thank you for presenting the bill. Any closing remarks? And then we'll lay the bill over.
Please support the bill.
All right, thank you so much. And that bill is laid over. Next, we will go to House File 4749. And I understand you have an A1 amendment. And it is our intention to amend the bill and then to lay it over.
Yes, that is my intent, Madam Chair.
Okay. So if you would please tell us about the amendment, and we'll adopt that, and then we will listen to the bill as amended.
Perfect. First off, the amendment is pretty standard. It changes, or pretty simple. It switches the central reporting to MINIT in coordination with the BCA and make sure that they have the responsibility for the report falls to MINIT. That's it.
Okay, that's the amendment. Okay. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A1, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. Now to House File 4749 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. On this one, with persistent and evolving cyber attacks increasingly targeting political subdivisions in the county, city, or municipal level, along with schools and universities, Minnesota would benefit from an improved information sharing. We know bad actors are actively looking for easier targets that may have less budget, less resources, or less technical expertise to fend off these ever-flowing attacks. While partners like MINIT and the BCA have much greater resources and a strong federal partnerships to address these potential threats, our local folks may not. From this knowledge, the concept of a more centralized way to share more relevant, timely information on potential threats with our partners in the county, city, and local school district level have emerged. Currently, a federal cybersecurity partner, CISA, share information with the state, who then in turn distributes this information to the local political subdivisions. These threat alerts are helpful, but they sometimes lack information about potential or active attacks at the local level. By reporting current or attempted attacks to the state, MINIT will be able to share information about threat vectors with others who may be impacted. Note that the intention here is deliberate. The intent is to only share what is being attacked and how, not who. By doing so, we encourage participation in this system, and we tailor the information necessary to address relevant threats without compromising the security of the reporting parties further. To prove out this model, each year, MINIT will compile data on the attacks to share with the Legislative Commission on Cybersecurity, of which I happen to be the chair at present, and share that with the state, the legislature, and the political subdivisions to have better data and be better informed about what types of resources are needed to best position the state to protect Minnesotans. In short, it helps us make informed, targeted investments in cybersecurity for our future. This bill basically creates a tool to share basic information about attacks and potential attacks to partners in the network and allows them to take preventative measures to share useful information and feedback and overall strengthen our organizational capacity in a very real way. As AI continues to emerge, hacking tools become more readily available to novice hackers, and the technology landscape continues to evolve. I'm certain Representative Nash could tell us more about that. But as that happens, we must be prepared to protect our security and the personal data of our citizens. States like Minnesota can lead the way on piloting programs to expand the base of knowledge around cybersecurity threats and be leaders on getting ahead of potential cybersecurity incidents before they cause the harm to infrastructure or personal data. Minnesotans expect us to take a proactive approach to our technology assets and our most valuable assets, Minnesotans themselves. I ask for your support of House File 4749 as amended. I do have John Israel, our CISO over at Minute, here to speak to the bill.
All right, I have on our list two testifiers for today, John Israel and Anthony Padron. So if you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Israel. I'm an assistant commissioner and also for Minnesota IT Services and also the Chief Information Security Officer for the state, working directly with a lot of organizations and entities throughout statewide on cybersecurity issues as well, just as part of our responsibility to kind of help organizations. This bill, I believe, furthers the steps and actions that Minnesota has taken over the last several years to build relationships with local governments and build out the capacity to share threat information quickly and in a timely manner. We have, as Representative Bonner spoke, we have great relationships with our federal partners at CISA, national organizations like the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center that share national information. But as we continue to see, getting information closer to local entities, getting information quicker, and being able to share those threat indicators as an early warning system will help organizations that are under attack and help prevent additional cyber attacks. Very often we see cyber attackers use the same methods. They find the same vulnerabilities, and very often software applications, vulnerabilities, and things are regional as well with common tools. So being able to build those relationships and formalize that through our relationship with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and information that we are sharing today through our cybersecurity partnership that Minute provides through the Fusion Center and others out to local governments. Building on that capacity is kind of critical to preventing these threats. Additionally, we're looking forward to the opportunity to be able to share aggregate information with the legislature and others to be able to help paint the picture of what the cybersecurity landscape and what that threat looks like as these threats continue to evolve from year to year.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony and we greatly appreciate the work you do for our state. So thank you. Next, we will have Anthony. I'm going to ask you to pronounce your last name for me because I know I've botched it twice now.
It's always easier to say than to read.
Thank you. All right, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Claiborne and esteemed committee members. I'm Anthony Paternus, the Executive Director of Technology for Osseo Area Schools. Today I'm here representing not only Osseo Area Schools, but also the Minnesota Association of School Administrators and the collective body of Minnesota K-12 technology leaders advocating in favor of House File 4749. The landscape of Minnesota's public education system is vast and intricate, serving over 870,000 students and employing over 126,000 individuals, each with digital records. These numbers reflect a significant portion of the state's population, highlighting the vast amount of digital information within public schools to ensure education services. However, behind these statistics lies a complex web of 331 public school districts, each with its unique challenges and resources. Whether overseeing a district with thousands of students or a smaller one with hundreds, the commitment to ensuring the security of digital resources and information remains unwavering. Yet it's essential to acknowledge the glaring discrepancies in available resources from districts with minimal staff to those like Osseo Area Schools with more extensive teams dedicated to digital technology security. The escalating threat of cyber events in K-12 schools cannot be ignored. 44% of educational institutions have been targeted by ransomware. costing millions to rectify successful attacks, the aftermath of such attacks extends far beyond financial implications, disrupting vital services and impeding educational processes, and underscores the urgency of bolstering our cybersecurity measures. Having previously testified before the Legislative Commission on Cybersecurity, I emphasize three critical areas requiring attention: the need for statewide K-12 technology leadership, adequate human and financial resources, and coordinated, timely communication. Our interconnectedness means that when one district faces a threat, others in the vicinity are often targeted as well. Last year's incidents in Minnesota and Iowa exemplify this reality, where swift action was imperative to safeguard our institutions. The situation in Minnesota left many K-12 technology leaders scrambling due to a lack of information. House File 4749 represents a pivotal step towards establishing a unified front against cyber threats. By fostering partnerships between K-12 entities and other public sector stakeholders, this bill facilitates the dissemination of real-time threat information and a deeper understanding of our threat landscape, empowering technology leaders to proactively mitigate risks. I commend MNIT and the bill's authors for their collaboration with K-12 technology leaders in crafting a solution aligned to our needs, and I encourage continued partnership should it pass, as any concerns with the legislation lies in the implementation and not the bill itself. In closing, I urge your support of House File 4749, recognizing its potential to enhance the cybersecurity resilience of our public schools and safeguard the future of Minnesota's education system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as a representative for the Osseo Schools District as well, I will say to you, I hear you in the K-12 infrastructure, human support, and timely communication. Thank you. Lead Nash, would you, did you want
to start? Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I will apologize to Representative Bonner. I had intended to add on to 4749. I'm doing that as we speak. Members, this is a good bill. Much like when you have a stroke or a heart attack, time matters, and it's very, very important. Commissioner Israel will tell you that if you're able to share information quickly with fellow colleagues as to what's going on in a cyber attack, they can take steps. And as was stated, sometimes it's a piece of software that is adopted by a large number of people across the state that people are, I'll just say it, lazy. They don't patch necessarily, or there may not be a patch that's available. Cyber attackers know these things. They use it to great effect. They start off with the juiciest target and work their way down. So being able to share this information quickly and disseminate it quickly matters very, very much. So I think this is a good bill. Madam Chair, what is the reference? What are we?
As amended, it is being laid over. And I also saw that Representative Nadeau had a question.
Well, I would hope that we find a way to get this into a policy bill, as with the previous, because both of them are important. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly, and thank you, Representative Bonner. Was this bill, so basically subdivision to 3.7 to 3.13, was this bill specifically crafted to focus on schools? And the reason that I'm asking, there's a lot of other partners that have cybersecurity issues, and a lot of the times the data is the same. I mean, it's a lot of the same populations that are in a lot of different data sets. And counties, for example, direct service providers that provide health and human services, case management, are they part of this, or was this bill specifically crafted, you know, really to focus on post-secondary?
And thank you. Representative Bonner, I'm going to ask you to keep your answer very short, but I also would like to bring to the attention of the committee the County Association letter of support in the file, too. All right. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, it is not specifically to you, although I will say that I'm very proud that my school district actually was a leader in helping us form and craft this legislation. But no, I think what we acknowledge is that the state has a great deal of expertise and knowledge in these areas, as well as the BCA. But we don't see that same level on the county level, the city level, those municipalities, our school districts or universities. And so this was really to try to find a way to disseminate information across all of those more local entities and give them better real-time information to thwart potential attacks or to address vulnerabilities within their own systems. Certainly, Mr. Israel may be able to speak more to that.
Just one follow-up, Madam Chair. And this is super quick, and it's Mr. Israel. So in the language it says, shall report within 72 hours. Is that pretty common across the board? I mean, so for example, if I have a direct service provider that has a cyber attack, I mean, is that something that counties will need to contractually obligate people that have access to private data within their contracts? Will they need to comply with this 72-hour requirement?
Assistant Commissioner Israel.
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, thank you for the question. The intent here there is no penalty for reporting. So kind of the intent here is to gather that early information as quickly as possible. To answer your question more specifically, 72 hours is a balancing act, really, to give time for entities to gather the information needed. Obviously, the quicker that an incident is reported, the better. So some compliance requirements, depending on what industry you are in and who is regulating that, may have a reporting requirement of 24 hours. For example, anything impacting a law enforcement agency, CJIS requirements that FBI puts out requires reporting within 24 hours. So the intent here is to accept those reports as quickly as an entity is able to make them, make that the relevant details and indicators shared out to other organizations. But there is no, it's more of a, there is no stick that follows it.
Thank you very much. And with that, we are going to lay over House File 4749 as amended. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I would like to ask Chair Pinto to come forward. House File 4959, which we are going to, I will make the motion to re-refer House File 4959 to the Public Safety Committee. I understand you have an A3 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do. And it's just... yes, Madam Chair, I do have that amendment.
Okay.
Sorry.
When you're ready.
Catching up. Yep.
No, you've been so patiently waiting.
No,
I appreciate
no
you.
And Madam Chair, regarding that amendment, it's just an adjustment to the task force membership, as I recall. I'm bringing it up here in response to a request. And so I'd ask that the members adopt that.
Thank you. And as it is the custom to get the bill in the order of the author's preference, all those in favor for the adoption of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A3 is adopted to House File 4959 as amended.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. Members, last session we enacted and appropriated funds for a report regarding effective approaches to the use of illicit drugs. This is in recognition of the harms and the ineffectiveness that our current approach has had, recognizing that despite enormous funds going to combat the use of drugs, we know that we have unprecedented continuous spikes in drug overdoses. We have the harms of criminalization in people's lives. We know that there continue to be the harms from drug use, and this is despite the approach we've taken for a number of decades. And so we commissioned this report. We've received a preliminary report. We'll receive a final one next year to look at what are the best practices all around the country and around the world relating to the use of illicit substances. House File 4959, as amended, is intended to be a companion to that, to say, well, we're getting these reports about what the research says, and we want to listen to that. But then there's the question of how we start converting what the research says into action. This is a very complicated issue having to do with chemical mentality treatment and mental health, obviously addiction and public safety, a number of issues. So this bill would establish a task force on holistic and effective responses to illicit drug use. I would hope we would want effective responses to such use and to do so in a holistic way. So the bill establishes this task force, membership duties, et cetera. The bill came out of the Public Safety Committee, but then as we looked at it, we realized that the best place to house this work within state government is with the Office of Addiction and Recovery. I think that I'm using, yes, I am using that correct term, which is within MMB, and that's what's caused the bill to have gotten amended to do that in public safety and be sent to this committee. I want to stress that the funds for the bill, if in fact it advances, would come out of the public safety budget as opposed to the budget of this committee, but because of where the task force is housed and this committee's expertise, we want to make sure to send it to you all. I have folks to answer questions, Madam Chair. I don't believe that folks had signed up on my behalf to testify for the bill, but simply to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And so, members, we're looking at lines 3.21 and 3.22 in the bill. Are there any member questions? I see no member.
That's the only thing
we're looking at? Well, that's why it's about where it's housed. The work is actually the work of the public safety. But if you do have a question, I would be somewhat lenient.
You know, no, I don't. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Representative Kosnick.
I did, Madam Chair. And just more in general, I kind of appreciate the bill and with some leniency. I just, being on a task force, actually the last interim with the chair, just had some concerns about task force. I think what we're trying to accomplish here, what I understand your intent to be, I would support. I had a question. My point of being is that sometimes task force gets set out with a predetermined outcome sometimes, and that would be sometimes concerning to me. You don't have any legislators on the membership of the task force. Not that the legislators have any of the answers or at all, but we are responsible for analyzing the report at the end of the task force, and so I think it's helpful to have legislators there that will work on the policy area back in the legislature. If you want to talk about that, and just more in general, is one of the policies that has been used in other areas is safe use zones, probably a more popular term. I don't know, you know, where it's safe to shoot up and whatever, and then they have nurses there or whatever. That's something that I would oppose. I don't think it's worked very well in other areas. On line 3.1, it talks about preventing harms to users. Is that one of the possible solutions or something that you think might be recommended to the legislature?
Chair
Pinto. Those two things, legislators and then that, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Kosnick. So to the point about legislators, in my experience with task forces, it really can cut both ways, right? Because I've certainly been aware of task forces, I think even before I was in the legislature, where there's legislators named, they don't necessarily show up. If they do, it just really varies. And on the other hand, we know that sometimes legislators, that has been my experience, right? In some cases, other times, of course, very actively involved. And I could imagine we could think of it in different ways. There are certainly advantages sometimes in having legislators beyond there in terms of having the confidence the recommendations are much more likely to be enacted. I think this is probably something to continue to discuss as to whether they be on there. I think, part of what we want to do here is to have the folks with the policy expertise really be working together. And we know that in the end, it's the legislature that gets to decide whether these proposals get enacted, which kind of connects to your second point as well, right? That you may individually, and it may be the legislature as a whole, says, hey, a particular recommendation, there is a recommendation that comes out relating to sites where folks can reduce harm and potentially where they would use narcotics, then we may say that's not something we want to pursue. We get the final word as legislators. So that's why, for me, in general, task forces, if there are legislators on there, I'm not so concerned, because I know that in the end, we get the final say as to whether something happens, because there's no power for this task force beyond simply making recommendations to us. So then that leads to that second point. And we certainly, at line 3.1, we certainly want to prevent harm to users of illicit drugs. I would hope everybody would agree on that. And then the question is, what is the best way to do that? We've had an approach that has said the best way to prevent those folks from being harmed is to criminalize them in general and charge them with crimes. I think there's pretty good research that safe injection sites can be helpful, but I also know that there certainly can be reasons to think that may not be the case. I will say, I individually, as a prosecutor, I don't have particular expertise on this, and the reason I wanted to push this last year was to say what we're doing is not working, and I want to get the best research to say what does work. So it may be that may be a proposal that comes out of this, maybe various things. We will then get to decide whether we adopt them or not. Long answer, but thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and I appreciate the curious and open mind that you have. So,
Madam Chair, I appreciate
Representative Kosnick.
I appreciate the discussion and the honest answer. If there's an openness to shoot up sites, I cannot support this.
Thank you very much. Seeing no further discussion, Lead Nash, did you want to say anything? Okay, then we will, the motion before us is to re-refer House File 4959 as amended to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 4959 as amended is re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, members.
And next we have Chair Freiberg. And we will have House File 4972 before the committee. It is our intention to lay this over. Is that correct?
Yes.
Chair Freiberg? All right. And with that, if you would please describe the bill to us.
Sure. This is a technical bill related to notaries and their registration with the Secretary of State's Business Services Division. Specifically, it aligns the process for holding additional authorizations that Minnesota notaries can seek to perform their duties, electronic notarization and remote online notarization. It aligns these processes by removing additional paperwork that a notary who holds an electronic notarization authorization is currently required to file each time they renew their commission. The bill also clarifies that a valid notarial stamp is not deficient because an element on the stamp has changed after the stamp was issued. As the letter from the National Notary Association in your packet states, this clarity is very important to ensure a valid notary stamp is not called into question. That's just the summary of the bill. I know the Secretary of State's office is here if there are any technical questions, but I don't think we have anyone signed up to testify on the bill.
I don't have anyone signed up to testify. Members, questions? Seeing no questions, we are happy to lay over, I'm just like, where did the number go? 4972 for possible inclusion in the state government finance and policy bill. Your bill is laid over. Okay. All right, I think I have the last two bills, which are also small and technical in nature. I don't know. There you are. All right.
Chair Cleborn, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. I'll start with House File 4798, which is a state government reporting requirement is repealed. And I have Eric Anderson from MMB with me to explain why they would like to have this repealed.
Mr. Anderson, state your name and your title.
Thank you, Chair and members. I'm Eric Anderson, Director of Government Relations at Minnesota Management and Budget. This MMB agency bill proposes to repeal an obsolete report on the amount of federal revenue, if any, that the federal government may withhold as a result of a potential state action to discontinue implementation of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. This report originated under previous federal education law, No Child Left Behind, at a time when state statute directed MDE to seek certain waivers of federal requirements and contemplated an opt-out of federal funding if those waivers were not obtained. But the relevant federal laws has since been replaced by the Every Student Succeeds Act, and Minnesota has an approved state plan since 2018, and state statute has since been updated to no longer contemplate a federal opt-out. So don't feel like the report is relevant anymore, and appreciate your support in removing it from statute.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Are there any other testifiers in the room? Seeing none, we move on to member discussion. Anyone would like to discuss the bill? Seeing none, we will move to lay over the bill, 4798, for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then the next bill we have before us is 4815. And I have with me Mr. Anderson to please discuss the need for this bill as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, once again, state your name and your title for the record.
Thank you. Still Eric Anderson, Government Relations Director at Minnesota Management and Budget. And again, another simple agency bill here to push back the due date for the uncollectible debt report from October 31st to November 30. We've had the opportunity to complete five of these, and the team that works on them would request a little bit more time to get the information together and ensure thorough vetting of what we're submitting to the legislature.
Once again, this is a public hearing. He's not up yet. Once again, this is a public hearing. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to speak? Seeing none, to member discussion. I believe Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Cleburne, thank you for bringing both of these bills together. It seems to have some support with it. Since there's no opposition, you could have just combined these two, and it wouldn't be log rolling.
Thank you very much for that clarification. But as I explained yesterday in the meeting, I had no idea what log rolling was, and it's not a practice that I intend to take up. Thank you. Oh,
glad. I appreciate that.
Representative, all right, here we go. So seeing no other discussion. Representative Harder. I didn't mean to address you.
I'll just start talking. Thank you, Chair. But I just have a question on the information that's obtained here that we're writing off as uncollected. Is that public knowledge? I mean, can the public know what's being written off, or what's the process with those uncollected debts?
I'll defer to MMB.
Oh, Mr. Anderson, sounds like you.
Sure. Would note that the required report, and or thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative, I would note the required report and statute is a summary. The agencies provide on a quarterly basis the uncollectible debts to MMB, and then the summary goes into this report.
And it is public.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Chair, Representative Harder, anything else?
No, thank you.
All right. Seeing no other discussion, the chair lays over House File 4815 for possible inclusion. And that concludes our meeting today. We are adjourned until, it's not on my cheat sheet, looks like Tuesday the 9th for our normal meeting time.
Thank you, everyone.